and I will be interviewing Warren Jones for the MSU Billings World War II Oral History Project.
All right. Well, I was born in Butte, August 2nd, 1920. City was under martial law. My family, my father was an attorney in Harlequin, Montana, and my mother, she came over there and stayed at friends' homes waiting for my birth. But she did the same thing when my sister was born 4 years later, because there was no hospital in Harlow at that time. And that which was kind of unusual, because at that time most women giving birth just gave birth at home, and there were midwives around, but not in my mother's case. And we lived in Harlow till 1926. My mother's family were ranchers south of town. The ranch is still there, still in the family. Our sons run it. But the Depression came along, and my father, who was born in Iowa and had come from Iowa, from Illinois to Montana to practice law, went back to Chicago because he just couldn't make a living in Harlow in the Depression in the 20s when it started. It started earlier there than it did nationally, but anyhow, story was that we had shoes and we could afford to walk out, and everybody else had to stay. So we lived in Chicago for 3 years, 4 years, where my dad was with a law firm there, and also with Vice President Dawes, First National Bank, I believe. But he got recruited from there because of trial experience to go with the Northwestern Mutual in Milwaukee, which is where we moved and where I got essentially all of my secondary education. We lived up on the north side in a suburb called Shorewood, which was a very prosperous suburb, and had great schools. That's why my folks picked that out. They scouted that around. And in fact, my son-in-law has just finished, I hope. He's been back there. He, oddly enough, went to the same high school that I did, but 15 years later, never knew him until after, until he married our daughter and met her out here. But anyhow, he has had the assignment of getting pictures of the four homes that we lived in Chicago, in Milwaukee, pardon me. And I haven't seen him yet because he's en route here. We'll be here in the first part of next month when, along with our daughter Pam, because we've got a wedding coming up in the family. Let's see, I got myself through high school now, haven't I? Wherein I took a lot of, I was, played football, took 4 years of Latin. That was the only language I took. My sister was a natural linguist. She took Latin. She always could talk in it. And she took German and Spanish, no French. She's the French teacher. And thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Oh, this is wonderful. My goodness, I'm going to come back. Thank you.
But from there, I went to Dartmouth College in New England. I put in 4 years there. This can get kind of involved. And I, interestingly enough,
you go ahead. You're fine.
Interestingly enough, while I was in college back there, those were the pre-war years from 38 to 42. New England was against our entry into the war, and I went to, and I think a lot of the faculty were there. The war ended World War II because a lot of them had fought in World War I. and they remembered what a carnage that was. They weren't sympathetic towards getting involved. We felt we should stay out of it. Of course, Pearl Harbor changed that. I remember the day that hit. I was December 7th, 1941. And it was just like somebody, the whole attitude changed within a minute. Everybody was great for going and getting a lot of fellows ran off and signed up right away. They didn't even finish college. And I did go down with some buddies to Boston. We went down and tried to enlist in the Marines. And I didn't make it. I couldn't pass the physical. Partly because of my heart. I'd been quite ill as a senior in high school and had a relapse my freshman year with pneumonia. And anyhow, I couldn't get in. Probably a good thing I didn't, because I don't think any of those, I don't even remember who they were now, but those who went down there, I don't think any of them survived the war. And I was, so I was lucky in that sense. Well, when I couldn't go right away, I had to do something. I came back, graduated, came back to Milwaukee. Already engaged to her. My dad and mother shipped me out to the ranch where I spent all my summers anyhow, if I could, though that summer I hadn't spent there. And I worked on the ranch and went over after about a year or 18 months out there. I went back over to Butte. I remember driving over with my granddad who took me over, and I tried to pass the Marine physical again. You know, I didn't mean to hog the napkins anyhow. And I didn't get by that physical. So came home, flew back to the ranch, we were working out there. And I mean, we were short of help. Well, I remember those days. And finally a friend of mine and I decided we'd had enough. We did not like working, being young men, what looked like both of us perfectly qualified physically to be in the military and not be in. So we went to town and I went in our stocks. Dad was chairman of the draft board, and we went in and said we want to get drafted. So we got drafted. And then I was married. I had been married. And I went back to Milwaukee, where she stayed with my parents, and worked there for Gimbel. She was trained, after she got out of college, she was trained as a buyer. She worked for Gimbel and also as a trainer, training salespeople. She graduated from Vassar the same year I graduated from Dartmouth.
But that's okay. It's good to know what you were doing beforehand. I just, you know, did your family feel about the war at that time?
Oh, they were, you know, they never. By the time I got, they never spoke out against it. They were for it. I never did. We were just indifferent in New England with Pearl Harbor. I mean, I tell you, we had several exchange students from Japan, and I remember a little Italian guy who really had no reason to be like that. Got on the fight and he was looking for these Japanese students who he was going to really clean up on them. Because we weren't yet at war with Italy, but Italy was a part of the Axis. Anyhow, they sequestered, they just scooped up those two, I think there were two or three of them, Mitzi Mitsui and another boy who his family had a history of being sent going to that school. And they just, the dean got them and they kept them at one dean's house, and then they were turned over to the government, and eventually they were repatriated. There was a time when I think we exchanged some Japanese people who were in this country, like, you know, like that ambassador and others, exchanged them for some of our people and tidied that thing up. But my dad's father had fought in the Civil War, lost a hand in the Battle of Lusaka. And that kind of, when my dad's father was gone to war, he was incredible. He enlisted in a brother. The brother had children, and he had a couple of children that would have been my aunts. So they'd have starved to death. They were saloon keeper in southern Wisconsin, and one of them where they went from, looked out for them, so they got fed and had shelter. And my father never said anything, but he took a dim view of the way the military had treated his father and his family. I found that true in another incident in World War II, quite interesting. There was a boy from Arlo by the name of Hent Manita, who fought with the 442nd. That you read military. They were the Nisi regiment, that the most decorated regiment in World War II. They had more Purple Hearts. They got more Congressional Medal of Honor than that. They got two or three, that's more than any other, you know, very rare. And Hank, his family, there's a guy, I don't know if you could interview him, that would be tough. He's still alive, he lives in Harlow, but his family was incarcerated. You know, I don't know where they were, and with some other students, they may have taken them down to what they call Heart Mountain, west of Douglas, Wyoming, and they had other places they incarcerated the Japanese. Nobody ever said anything about incarcerating Italians or Germans, just Japanese. And he fought with that unit, the 442nd, I think Sataki did too. But Hank came home and he was very bitter about the treatment his family got and the way he was treated as kind of an outcast. And he was one of the crack units in World War II. I saw a mountain in Italy that those guys went up during the night, cleaned out the Germans. And a whole battle. But anyhow, now, when, you know, the VFW and the Legion, we'd try to get Hank to go. He wouldn't join the Legion or the VFW. We all got along with him real great. He worked as a teller in the bank. He's retired now. But it's only, I understand, in the last couple of years that we'd always ask Hank to go to something for an armistice day or some Legion do, and he wouldn't go, but now he's started. But, boy, those things, what happened to him, left some deep wounds. Now, where are we?
That was interesting. I'm glad you brought that up. We'll just go ahead with, what was your opinion regarding Germany and Japan before the war?
Well, before the war?
Yeah. What was your opinion of them? Did you have any,
I didn't have an opinion, and neither did a lot of Americans.
Right.
It's very interesting, and I've often thought about it. They had the National Guard here in Montana, you know. And they got called up a year and a half before the war started. And went out to Fort Lewis, Washington. Company D, all these kids from Harlow, and the reason they belonged to it was depression was on. Hell, they didn't belong to it because they were hot to protect the country. They belonged to it because they got a paycheck every 2 weeks where they'd go to a training session or whatever they did. And the whole community was kind of involved with Company D then, because a lot of these young men in town belonged to it, and for that reason. And yet my experience in, when I lived in Milwaukee, the guy next door to me, I don't know who he was, but he was a major in the U.S. Army, and he was up there as part of military reserve. I never knew his name. He had two little kids. He was about the same rank as Eisenhower at that time, and I don't know what became of him. Hell, he could have been a four-star. He could have been old enough so that when the war did get going, that he would have been, couldn't go because he was over age or something. But anyhow, that's why they, none of them will admit that now, but by God, that's why they belong to the Guard, because they had some spending money and money to go home to supplement what little they had, some of those range kids. But in Milwaukee, you didn't hear anything about the Guard. And none of my classmates in high school got mixed up with the Guard. They all, that's very interesting, my high school class only lost one boy in a class of about, probably had 150 boys in it. Oh, not that many. About, I think a whole class had 175 boys in it. They all went in, but one boy got killed, and he got killed right near the end of the war. A Jewish boy named Jack Abrams. He used to live right down the street a few hours from home. But, so we didn't have, now, my college class, my mother, after the war, was back there with my brother-in-law, who was going to Tuck School after the war was over. He'd been a naval officer. Fascinating career, too. But anyhow, she kept track of what happened to the members of my class. She kind of knew them, had a yearbook, and some of them came back and went to school, but there was at least 30 or 40 of them got killed. And we had a class of close to 10% of them. I just wrote this, if I can find that picture. Pictures taken from him. It's a picture of a bunch of naval aviators. But if you comment, I knew one of them quite well, and he survived the war with a naval fire.
It's fine.
Oh, here it is. This is interesting. Nearly a quarter of the class of 1942 would become naval aviators or Army Air Force pilots. So a quarter of the guys I was with ended up flying. And this is the one I knew, Bill Dahlberg. He survived. He was a naval pilot, and he survived the war. And then a couple or three of these were killed. They were in a different class. But it's interesting that that many of them were Air Force. And for some reason, that issue's got a bunch of old pictures.
Going back. Do you remember, you already told me a little bit about when Pearl Harbor happened and where you were and what you were doing. Do you remember what your initial response was? Just shock, huh?
Let's go get them. Yeah. That's what the shock was. There were guys running around wanting to sign up right now. And some did.
And your family responded pretty much the same in your community?
Yeah. As far as I know, I wasn't around them at that moment. But, yeah, that was the feeling. Just everybody's going to have to go. We thought we'd walk off and slap them around a few times and the war would be over. Ha, ha, ha. We found out different. But that was the reaction. The gut feeling was, let's get on with the job. And we had, incidentally, that school had a lot of boys, not a lot, but a number of them, who had been to Shattuck or Culver or St. John's military schools, under, you know, instead of high school. And you don't, I guess Shattuck's still operating. But these, and as part of their going there, they were, they had enough training so they could be taken right into the service and commission. And they didn't need a lot of training. So the next thing you notice, your classes suddenly got a little small. A lot of the guys had been sucked up by the government, sent off. I had one classmate by the name of Carney, whose dad was Admiral Carney. And I don't know what he was doing up there. I guess he couldn't get into the Naval Academy, so they had him up there. But he went into the Marine Corps, and he became a general. I don't know how high he got. In the Marine Corps, but then you know the famous picture of the guys raising the flag on Suribachi and the fighting in Saipan, that picture of him raising, that was his company that he commanded. And at the same time that was happening, his wife, who was the daughter of General Sullivan, that shows you how these people all kind of get together. His wife was the daughter of General Sutherland, who was MacArthur's chief of staff. And she was having a baby the same day that both guys were going up the mountain and planting that flag. That's just a little something I picked up, you know, in college.
That's very interesting. That's something we want to hear.
They called his dad Tin Can Carney. He commanded the North Atlantic Destroyer Fleet. He had been Halsey's chief of staff in the Pacific. And there was a girl in Harlow by the name of Halsey, whose grandfather was Admiral Halsey's brother. She's quite a track star. Was, she's now down at some school in Beaver in North Dakota. Maybe, I think she's at Fargo, at the University of North Dakota. Anyhow, that's just all these names.
They kind of come back. What do you remember most about basic training?
I remember most about trying to figure out a way to avoid it. And I was pretty damn good at it. Well, when I went into the military, I went from Butte to Salt Lake City. Now, Salt Lake was where I was inducted at Fort Douglas. And then they shipped us on a troop train from there down through the mountains where I'd never been to Tyler, Texas. And where we were near Tyler, but actually we pulled into a
built right on the base, so they could unload troops. I know we got in there in the middle of the night, and we just came filing out, and there we were. From then on, it was a case of getting uniforms.
But this time you're a college graduate.
Yeah.
And you're married.
Yeah.
And so you're about 22,
23? I was older, a lot older than the kids that were with me. And see, that inability to get in and putting it off I ended up with guys that, I ended up with some people in the military who couldn't read or write. I used to, in the barracks, they'd get a letter from home, and I'd read the, bring it to me, and I'd read this enemy's letter to this guy from his wife or girlfriend, and then write something back, and, you know, so I'd sit there, and he'd dictate to me, and I'd write something down, and he'd mail it home. Hey, those guys there, they were taking in men who couldn't read or write. They'd send them to Camp Atterbury, Indiana first, and they taught them the rudiments, though, when you say halt, you stop. And they were fellows that really didn't have a mental ability to make reliable soldiers. You have to fill the slot, I remember, on a machine gun. These machine guns, and the machine gun will get hot. And it runs away. It keeps the heat, keeps it firing, and it'll run by itself. And if you let go of the trigger, it doesn't stop. It just goes to the belt, and there you twist the belt. Well, this guy was standing right by this kid, and the machine gun started, well, you could tell it was running away. And he just was laying on his belly, and he just started crawling backwards to let go of the machine gun. He didn't try to shut it off or anything. And it was spraying bullets all over out there. All he knew was it no longer would do. He wanted to.
Wow.
And he was leaving.
Did you feel you were mentally prepared for what was ahead?
To some extent. I think I was. Because I was older and I'd read a lot of stuff about war. And at that time, Ernie Pyle was doing a lot of, wrote some books, you know. I never did get into any combat. So whether I was prepared for that, I have no idea. Nobody does till it happens. And some guys, I think, they just are so hyper by then that they just sort of ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
And also get themselves killed with these.
So where did you go right at the beginning? Once you had basic training out of the way?
I was shipped out to Fort Meade, Maryland. Some of us went to, my bunch was going to the ETO. And I went off late because I applied for officer's candidate school and it hadn't come back. Well, I didn't need any officers right then, so I didn't get in. Anyhow. And we went to Fort Meade. She came down, and I was, that's just out of Washington, D.C. She came down, and her dad was, and her mother was staying in Washington because he had this important job with the war effort on leave from his company. And I got in there, and I remember we went up to Mayflower Hotel. Went with her dad. Here I was, a private, just millimeters, no nothing, no scraps. And we were dancing, and Myrna Loy was there. And her husband, you remember her hearing her? She was from Alma, famous movie star. Her husband was an admiral. And they were dancing on the floor, and we were dancing on the floor. And I remember that evening quite well. But then I had to go right back to camp. And then she had to go home. And I got back up there, and I'd come down, and there was a guy from Arlo by the name of Cosby, who since then he had a relative, Mary, and everything. But he had been in the Guard. He was an officer. And he got hurt in an ambulance accident, I think. He was, however, he had been assigned to this kind of, just as an officer in the camp, so you know, your structure's there, you've got guys doing things. He looked me up, because my aunt wrote and told him I was there. And he had went to the base headquarters, and there were 7 Warren Joneses. Turned out I was in the battalion right next to his. Anyhow, he looks me up. He gets me a pass. That night we go into, he was living in Baltimore with his wife, who later became a school teacher out here, taught in Laurel, not Laurel, but Lovina, and in Harlem. After he spent the night there at his house and drinking whiskey. I went to bed, got up, started moving around in the morning, drank some coffee, and went back to camp. Neither one of us fit to do anything, but to feel better after a few hours. And then right after that, I got shipped out, and we went down to Camp Patrick Henry in Newport News, Virginia. They had opened the camp just for this shipment. I remember, and it's in the trees, timber everywhere. And it was a place where they'd stage, you could put a whole division in there of men, not necessarily with all their equipment and trucks, but you could stage them. And then when it came time for us to get on the ship, they loaded us up on the train and drove. Train went right down to Newport News and right out on the dock. And we got off, and here was this big ship. They loaded us up on it. It was the USS West Point, then, which had been renamed during it was America's largest luxury liner. It had been the USS America, but when I got on it, they had renamed it the USS West Point. And troops. The dining room had bunks that would go up about 8 bunks high. And where I was, there were only 4 or 5 bunks high. The only bad part about ours is that we were back near the fantail, and rougher back there, and that's where the dispensary was. And of course, we got into a hell of a storm. And everybody, I don't get seasick. Because there were guys laying outside that dispensary, just had given up. They wouldn't let them go near the edge of it for fear they'd fall in. They just lay there in the hallway and heave. I don't know how they cleaned it up. They probably got a hose and hosed everything down into the mess. Wondered where we were going, and we ended up in Naples. I remember when we went through the Institute of Water. And Roosevelt died while we were in the group, too. And then became president. Nevertheless, we went on to Naples. And we were unloaded. They couldn't get that big ship. Well, the Naples Harbor still had a lot of ships that the Germans had hit, you know, with bombs in their land, and their mast sunk. And they pulled us up alongside the bottom of one, and there was a wooden ranch built down over for 100 yards to
short, or was it barrel?
And we all marched down all of that, and we got into my trucks, yeah, I'm sure you're familiar. They were pulled by the big truck, but they were long, they were probably about 30 feet long. They weren't as big as some of them. And they used them a lot for hauling cargo, but when they got a big bunch of troops show up, they packed us in there. No place to sit down, you're all standing. So it's all full, and then some big first sergeant would stand up and yell, "These guys are gonna have the body hurt." Or he'd say, "You'll be sorry." And we were, but then the truck took off and left Naples. We wound out through that destitute city that was off limits mostly to American troops. It was there and went on up past Caserta, which was where the headquarters of theater operation was, and 5th Army headquarters were there too. And we went up to the Volturno River, which was just south of, kind of east of Cassino, because Italy lays on an angle, you know. And when you think you're going east and west, or you're going actually northwest and northwest, you get screwed up really easy. Anyhow, they took us out to this replacement camp, dumped us in there, and issued us a rifle. Remember that. They got these rifles and they were just out, they would pull them out of barrels of cosmoline. Cosmoline is kind of a grease. And most all guns to the military piece were packed in them. The barrels were full of them, the breeches full of the bullet, and all the mechanism was full of this grease, and all we had to get to office. You gotta have gasoline, you gotta kind of get it all, you gotta take the gun all apart and clean out the barrel, and a hell of a big job. And I got mine good and clean. They were old guns, you could take a bullet. And one guy had a gun, you could take a bullet. Just not the whole shell, but the bullet. And drop it down the barrel. And the barrel was so worn it would go clear to the breech. Normally they're tight, you know, the hell you can't push one in by hand. Anyhow, we went out and fired a little on the range, I did. But right then the war ended, and the colonel who was running the camp said, "One guy got killed on November 11th when the war ended. Settled personal fights and they all had their guns and they'd start fighting amongst themselves. So we're going to take all your guns away from them." So they did. And we just had to throw them in. Before, when they'd been issued, they wrote down the number of the rifle and all that. Well, after about 2 or 3 days and they came, we weren't going to have a big shootout or a fight of any kind. We just celebrated the end of the war, is all we did. Why then, gave a rifle back. But they just gave you a rifle. And it looked good, mine looked good on the outside. And when you were going to go out firing, I looked in the barrel and it was my Cosmo. From one end to the other, if I fired that gun, it had blown up my face. So I cleaned that one up. And then, after that, while we were there, we went on a lot of training exercises. Military, which is a good thing. They were teaching us patrol tactics, and at night we'd follow a compass course, and we were trying to find something out. And then they had a combat course. I remember that. This was before the war ended, too. And
they had arranged this like a big cooler with a flat bottom and a creek running through it. And on the far side of the side we were on where we started, they had set up all the German weapons. Big 80 millimeter mortars, regular mortars, that were and machine guns that were firing over our heads. And then we had to crawl in lanes. They had the lanes marked so to keep us in, because between the lanes they had planted dynamite every now and then. I've seen them from here to the wall in the front of it. And you're in a lane only about as wide as this room, and you're crawling down there and crawling under barbed wire, and there's machine guns are going di-di-di-di-di, and then shooting right over your head. You can hear them. And you can see the tracers. And then they were firing big 80 millimeter mortars. They'd land way out. They'd make a hell of a racket. Well, it had blown off this dynamite. And the guy who ran the course, a captain, had been assigned to this job because of he'd become a casualty of the war. In other words, he was emotionally upset. He just decided, I'm going to show these guys what we like out there in the army. He doubled up those dynamite charges that were in there, and I don't know how they fired them. They had some wires remotely, you know. They were supposed to represent a shell hit. Well, those things started going off, and we were crawling along, and I know you'd be laying flat. You'd go that high off the ground from just the concussion of that. Well, everybody panicked and froze. And then we wouldn't keep moving. We wouldn't keep going. And this guy went ape, I guess he said back around the hill. He had a hurry pistol. He was shooting at it, guys. He was supposed to send up a light to signal to start or stop or anything. He just went nuts, and he started, I mean, he didn't hit anybody, but those things were coming in, and, well, the whole thing sort of collapsed, and we went back to camp, and we caught hell with, we had done froze and done this wrong, and not done a good job, so the word was we were going to go back out and do it again. By then they started asking a few questions of why these guys stopped, and at other times they'd run the problem and they didn't stop. Well, they found out about the captain, and he had intensified the dynamite, and he had run. Luckily he didn't get hold of the machine. We had those snipers from the Germans, I don't know what to shoot about, but well, they kept them in ammunition, and they just go. It just sounded like that, and then the bullets going over. It gets your attention. But about that time, three of us got assigned to the headquarters company. That was that one. Because they had a slick system. Our phone. And you don't get the Form 20, a big yellow card, and all around it, it had numbers in different categories. And they wanted them. Everybody had a number. All the numbers over 500 were military specs, like an infantryman was a 745. Civilian occupations, like a cook, was an 060, small man. And if they wanted cooks, they'd have these cards, they'd take them out, shove these things, look like darning needles, through this big stack of 120, and sub for a 06 and another 0 hole. Lift them up and shake it, and all those who were cooks fall out. You could do that with any specification.
And they would, and they had on it your, you know, your IQ was on there. And that's how we got scooped up. Because one boy, Taylor, and I still know him. And the other boy, Vic Fisher, was a chemist. And it was he and I, and those two men and myself, we got sent on TDY to Rome. And that's where we got into the Pope.
You said TDY?
TDY means temporary duty.
Okay.
I don't think I have. I think she's got some personal military order where it says following EM, enlisted EM. Half of it is just an alphabet, like EDCMR, means effective date change mooring report. In other words, you're supposed to be there by that day. We're added to the roster of wherever we were going and taken off the roster wherever we came from.
So they knew where you were?
Well, yes. That's yeah. Where the military kept track of. They may have changed.
Yeah. Did you ever do anything for good luck? Was there something that you did just to kind of feel a little safer? How did you entertain yourselves?
Well, after that, I never did, I didn't need anything like that because we got shipped out. Now, we were, fortunately, the war ended before we got to Japan because our unit was scheduled to go in Japan and land on the second day. And, that was going to be a very bad deal. And, of course, we got through the canal, got out into the Pacific Way, and the Octagon and the war ended. And then all these guys had enough, a lot of them had enough points. We were kind of hoping that ship would turn north and go up to San Francisco. Instead, it kept steaming up for we went to Islandia, New Guinea. Only one guy got off to go visit him. He had a brother in a medical in a hospital unit there. And let him off to go see his brother. And this troop ship